Hello and welcome to a special edition of The Correspondent, a podcast of the Foreign Correspondents Club of Hong Kong. My name is Jared Watt, and in this episode, you're going to hear the full and unedited audio of a lunchtime panel discussion recorded at the FCC on February the 19th. The panel discusses the plans of the Hong Kong government to introduce Article 23 to what's known as Hong Kong's constitution, the Basic Law, enabling it to enact laws prohibiting seven offences, including treason, espionage, and theft of secrets. You'll hear a discussion featuring three prominent and pertinent people leading the debate about Article 23 in Hong Kong, including Ronson Chan, the current chair of the Hong Kong Journalist Association, Regina Ip, member of the Hong Kong Legislative Council, convener of the Executive Council, and formerly the Secretary for Security, who had originally supported the introduction of Article 23 back in 2002, and you'll hear from Professor Simon Young, who is a practicing barrister as well as the Ian Davies Professor in Ethics at the University of Hong Kong. But before we hear from them, you're going to hear an excerpt of the official submission made by the FCC to the Hong Kong government as part of the public consultation period on Article 23. You can read the full document submitted by the board on behalf of the FCC membership on the FCC Hong Kong website at fcchk.org. And it was also posted to the FCC HK Twitter account. And now, given the submission was signed off by the entire FCC board, we thought it only fair to use an AI-generated voice to represent the 17 members of the board. Here's what the submission has to say.
With a membership base of more than 2,000 journalists, diplomats, business people, and other dedicated members of the Hong Kong community, the Foreign Correspondents Club of Hong Kong welcome the opportunity to participate in the public consultation on the Article 23 National Security Legislation. The way this legislation is written and implemented will have profound implications for the rights and freedoms guaranteed by Hong Kong's Basic Law, including the way news is gathered and reported. Protecting those rights and freedoms, including freedom of the press, is crucial for preserving Hong Kong's role as an international business and media center. We therefore put forward our suggestions for consideration, which can be summarized as follows. Firstly, we consider the inclusion of a public interest defense clause in the legislation is paramount. Secondly, the definition and the scope of state secrets, misprision of treason, sedition and foreign interference contained in the consultation document are too broad in nature, such as the uncertainties that will arise affecting the legitimate work of journalists. We offer our views regarding certain offenses in the consultation document as follows. Misprision of treason. Under the current proposal, a news organization or journalist could potentially be prosecuted if deemed to have knowledge of any planned or existing treason without disclosing this information to the police. There are certain exceptions allowing for legal professional privilege, but not for journalistic privilege. We wish to point out that a significant part of a journalist's duty is making contact and interviewing people who may have knowledge or information, which might constitute an offense in law. However, it is almost impossible for the news media to judge if someone's act is endangering national security. Therefore, a clear statement of a public interest defense should be included in Article 23 to enable the news media to operate with legal bounds, since the journalist would have no intention to breach the law when making a legitimate news report that is clearly in the public interest. Seditious intention. The proposed wording of the offence may effectively extend its coverage to include criticism of the Hong Kong government, unless the publication is deemed to be with a view to improve the constitutional order or the system. With respect, these exceptions could be subjective and do not necessarily apply to the news media or op-ed articles which may contain such criticism. For this reason, we request a clear statement of public interest defence for the better protection of news media. Fair criticism or comment on governmental decisions or policies is a key aspect of press freedom and, we submit, assists in maintaining fair and open financial markets, as well as encouraging constructive dialogue between interest groups and the Hong Kong government. State secrets. The concept of state secrets has been introduced by Article 23 as an expansion to the existing Official Secrets Ordinance, covering unlawful acquisition, unlawful possession, and unlawful disclosure of state secrets at the same time. This expanded definition of state secrets would cover issues that are also of public interest or matters of public debate. Nevertheless, the consultation document clearly stated that the government will try to strike a proper balance between the protection of state secrets and the protection of the right to freedom of the press. We therefore ask for the inclusion of a clear statement of a public interest defence in order to allow for a defence of lawful disclosure of information by news media if it is determined by a judge that such disclosure is in the public interest. External interference. This offence is provided with a very broad interpretation of what constitutes using improper means in engaging in conduct with external forces. Also, it is hard for any individual to define concepts including placing, quote, undue spiritual pressure, unquote, on a person. Hence, any broad interpretation means legitimate journalism is at risk of being deemed illegal under Article 23 without appropriate definitions or defences in place. We therefore consider that a statutory exemption by way of a public interest defence is critical in order to bridge this gap.
And now for the panel discussion with Ronson Chan, Regina Ip and Simon Young, moderated by the current president of the Foreign Correspondents Club of Hong Kong, Lee Williamson.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon to those joining us here in person in the main dining room of the FCC. Good afternoon to those of us downstairs in Burt's within the club who are watching on the live stream. And good afternoon to those watching the live stream around the world. Thank you for joining us for this club lunch on the enactment of Article 23. My name is Lee Williamson. I'm the president of the Foreign Correspondents Club Hong Kong. There are now 10 days remaining in the month-long Article 23 consultation process. The government's 110-page consultation paper on legislating Article 23 of the Basic Law focuses on five types of offences: treason, insurrection, theft of state secrets and espionage, sabotage, and external interference. To discuss this proposed legislation, I'm joined by representatives from government, journalism, and legal sectors. Regina Ip, sat here in the middle, has served the Hong Kong government since 1975. She has been a member of the Legislative Council since 2008 and is currently the convener of the Executive Council. The founder and chair of the New People's Party, Mrs. Ip was also Secretary for Security in 2003 when she was a prominent sponsor of Article 23 legislation the last time it was introduced. Ronson Chan, sat next to me here, is the chairperson of the Hong Kong Journalists Association. A former deputy assignment editor for Stan News before its closure in December 2021, he is now multimedia supervisor for news at Channel C. And finally, sat furthest away from me, Professor Simon Young, who is the Ian Davies Professor in Ethics at the University of Hong Kong's Faculty of Law and a practicing barrister with Parkside Chambers. He's also the editor-in-chief of the Asia-Pacific Journal on Human Rights and the Law. Inaki Amati, chairman of the European Chamber of Commerce, who was advertised to be part of this panel, is unable to join us today due to travel commitments. Mrs. Ip, let's start with the government perspective. The Hong Kong Crimes Ordinance has existing laws covering sedition, treason, and official secrets, and the Beijing drafted and mandated national security law, which was enacted in 2020, also has statutes covering secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign organizations. Why does the government believe that Hong Kong remains in need of its own domestic security legislation?
Thank you for the question. You will have noticed that the government's proposals do not cover secession and subversion because they have been dealt with in Beijing's national security law. So there's no need to tinker with it. But Basic Law Article 23 requires Hong Kong to prohibit seven national security offenses. So the government needs to put forward proposals basically to update and modernize what we already have on the statute books. Now, this legislative exercise does not involve laws that are coming out of the blue. We already have a body of laws on treason, sedition, theft of state secrets, espionage, already in the statutes we inherited from Britain. So what the government is doing is to work on them, to update and modernize them, For example, the offense of spying currently is to make a drawing or a model of a prohibited place. As we all know, with the advance of technology, nobody goes near a prohibited place to do a drawing or a model. So you need to take into account the advance of technology. And also the government has taken into account new legislative provisions introduced by other countries, prominently Australia, UK, Singapore, to deal with external interference, you know. So that's about it. And I think the proposals are actually less broad or sweeping than a lot of the similar proposals introduced by other common law jurisdictions.
We'll absolutely come into that point. So what you're saying is the law is about modernizing, and it's also about creating new acts to cover new offenses. Professor Young, one of these offenses that is being talked about, one of the ways that this law, a perceived threat to this law is supposed to counter, is so-called soft resistance. Secretary for Security Chris Tang has spoken of Article 23 as a way to counter soft resistance. A, quote, soft resistance approach is even referred to in Chapter 2 of the consultation document without too much further elaboration. So what would the legal definition of soft resistance be, and what laws that are proposed in the consultation document would apply to this purported threat?
Right. Well, thanks, Lee. Thanks, FCC. Honored to be here. Now, the document refers to soft resistance, as you've mentioned, in one place, but that is where it is enumerating the different risks and highlighting that soft resistance can, if you allow it to accumulate and you don't do anything to condemn it or stop it, it can actually get very serious. So it's in that context that the report refers to soft resistance. Now, I don't think the proposals were intended to address soft resistance per se. There's no offense that was created to say that this is a real problem that we have to now criminalize all forms of soft resistance. However, it does propose that we maintain the offense of sedition. And sedition could be seen as a kind of offense that deals with soft resistance. But it's in the context of making statements and citing others, basically to hate or to be in contempt of the basic systems in the Constitution, the government. Where the so-called soft resistance is directed in that way, then you have sedition to cover that.
Mr. Chan, how would you define this term that is being used quite frequently in the public discourse, soft resistance? Mrs. Ip.
I agree with Professor Young that there are no proposals in the document to prescribe soft resistance, probably because it's not practicable. It's very hard to do that when something is soft. That is something in publications or in social media that are not against the law. You know. And I note also the document stresses in the part concerning sedition. It refers to Section 9, Bracket 2 of Crimes Ordinance that the offense of sedition will not prescribe constructive criticisms of government policies or making suggestions to improve government policies. These are existing provisions in Section 9, Bracket 2 of Crimes Ordinance, and the consultation document stresses retaining those provisions to protect the freedom of expression.
Mr. Chan, what is the position of the HKJA on the consultation document's proposed legislation, particularly with regard to the lack of a public interest defense?
First of all, I'm still very nervous because I started my internship in 2003 and I covered the news for the legislation of the Article 23 in 2003 and meet Regina many times before 20 years ago. It's quite unimaginable that I can discuss the Article 23 with her on the same station here, with English especially. It's very unimaginable. But another thing is unimaginable is the atmosphere has changed. I think that it's quite acceptable for the 2003 legislation for the provision and proposal raised by the government at that time. Today, we can see that the law, I think it's not only modernization, it's also had more content, and the context have been added. For JA, we represent most of the professional journalists. We have issued a questionnaire to our members, and we have got around one sixth of them response. Over 90% of us showing that we think that Article 23 legislation may affect our work most. Over 75% think that the effect is in the negative effect for our work. I think for our most concern is the national secret a part of the consultation, especially that it raised seven criteria of the a national secret. It almost include all the matters around the world that what will happen, including the information about economic development, crime investigation, which this kind of context we are frequently read in the newspaper and the media. Mm. So, as you mentioned for the public interest terms, I think if we have such protection, it's good. But I don't think it really had any actual or very affectable meaning to us, because we cannot only see the article, we have also to see what had happened and how the judge said. In the past 1 year, we can see that in the court, the judges use a very conservative and very narrow mind to think about the rise, especially when we're talking about freedom of speech or the freedom of press, that most of the time the judges said it in the judgment that they would say that rise is not absolute. It must have some an imitation or something. So we can see that even such public interest terms added into the articles, it does not mean that we are easily to get the protection from it. It still depends on the manner and the force from the judges.
So what you're saying is JA is asking for more clarity. So I assume Hong Kong Journalist Association will be making a submission as part of this consultation process. What will you be including in this submission? The consultation document states that, quote, the HKSAR government is of the view that it is necessary to clearly define state secrets, clearly define so that public officers, government contractors, and the general public can understand what secret matters constitute state secrets. There's no specific mention of the press in this passage or much of anywhere in the document, but how could state secrets be clearly defined in a way that would enable reporters to do their jobs without fear of inadvertently breaking the law?
I remember that I've asked Chris Tan, the Secretary for Security, in the policy address press conference. I asked him that if we're using the terms of state secret, as if by the meanings, the definition for mainland concept or a local concept, he answered me that we will use the local concept. However, if you were reading the consultation paper, it stayed clearly that there's only one concept for national security in the whole country, including mainland and Hong Kong, and it stated the matters related to the national security and the national secret is related to the 20 spectrums, including technology, environmental, ecology, or whatever. So I really think that if we go through such the way to think about the national security, it's not easy to give a more precisely or a small group to stay carefully what is the national security or national secret. Mm-hmm. But for us, we still hope that in the consultation paper or on the coming legislative articles that it still have a more clear area or scope that what is the national secret. We agree that, for example, until now for the official secret ordinance is they care about defense, national defense, and the diplomatic matters that may be related to such. We agree that we may have a more clear and more small group area to stay clear what is national secret.
So let's look at a specific example, Mrs. Ip and Professor Young. In defining what state secrets are, the consultation document makes explicit reference to the scope of state secrets under relevant mainland China laws. Seven types of state secret, as Ronson said, are listed in the consultation document, which fall in line with the language used in China's guarding state secrets law. One of these, secrets concerning the economic and social development of our country, or the HKSAR, quote unquote, has raised some eyebrows in the journalism and business communities. So let's road test a case study, if you will, a hypothetical. China stopped publishing its youth unemployment data for about 6 months last year, but was presumably still collecting this data. If a journalist sitting in Hong Kong was handed this data and published it, would they be violation of this national security law as it is currently proposed? Mm-hmm. Mrs. Ip, Professor Young, whoever wants to take that first.
If I could give a longish answer, what the consultation proposes is harmonization of terms, because in mainland China they have a 国家秘密法. No, they use the term mimi. In Hong Kong, we use the term jimi. So the first proposal is to harmonize the terminology. We will also use the term mimi. But as for the categories of information that will be covered under state secrets, under existing law, official secrets ordinance, which we inherited from the British, we already have at least five categories of information, which are protected, And the consultation document mentioned seven categories, which is similar to what the China's national secret law has. But basically, we are talking about, number one, a limited number of categories of information. Number two, the precondition is that access to this sort of information has to be restricted, because of the nature of the information must be restricted. Secondly, you only fall foul of an offense if publication of this sort of information without lawful authority endangers national security. So there are strict preconditions. It's been put to me that one of the categories is information relating to the social and economic development of Hong Kong, something like that. If it is something already social and economic development of our country or the Hong Kong SAR, if it is already something in the public arena, like the minimum wage or the poverty line or even the budget deficit after 28 February, then it's not something access to which has to be restricted. So it has to be, the most important precondition is it must be information that will endanger national security, and the threshold is high. Every prosecution needs to be authorized by the Secretary for Justice, and criminal conviction, we all know, need to prove beyond any reasonable doubt. So with this precondition, I don't think the media really need to worry.
Professor Young, I have two questions for you. First off will be my original question, which is this hypothetical.
Yeah.
As you understand the proposed legislation, would my hypothetical situation be in violation of this law?
Yeah. So let me explain, based on what is in the consultation document, on how I would process such a question. So we look at the definition of state secret. One of the important criteria, which Mrs. Ip has highlighted, is it's not just any government information, right? It has to, if it's disclosed, be likely to endanger national security. Okay, that's a bit vague, but at least it could be a safeguard. But the other important thing is this, is that it still has to be a secret. It still has to be a secret. So the consultation document is a bit unclear about what's the definition of a secret. I would think that it has to be something that you reasonably expect to be confidential. Right, so if it's, as Mrs. Yip said, if it's already generally known, then it couldn't be a secret, right? So I think that would be another important safeguard. But the other important thing is you have to then turn to the offenses. Because you have to look at what's the mental element, the mens rea requirement for the offenses. And there are three offenses, acquisition, possession, and disclosure. And they all share the same mens rea. Right? You either know that it is a state secret, right? Or the alternative is that you have reasonable grounds to believe and you have the intention to endanger national security. Right? Now, I have to highlight this. That the proposals have been very thoughtful in general because you see this expression repeated in many of the proposals with the intention to endanger national security. So as a criminal lawyer, when I see that, I'm happy because that's the highest level of mens rea. It's not easy to prove that. And that's a very important safeguard. So if you have that in there, right, then it's not just any kind of, you know, knowledge or disclosure. You have to show that that person really intended to endanger national security, right? But if they're, you know, doing legitimate journalism business, and it's unlikely they would have that intention.
Professor Young, I'll come back to you on this definition of threats to national security and proving that. But first, Mr. Chan, what does it mean for investigative journalism when journalists can only publish things which are already in the public domain?
I don't think that we needed to talk about investigative journalism. It's just a daily operation for a newsroom. I could raise some examples to you. For example, several months before that, there is news come from Financial Times stating that a submarine was had in the accident and several sailors and the pilots were died. And for my working-based channels here, I was not allowed to publish this news because I think that it related to the military information, and I'm afraid that it's related to the military secrets. I would like to say is how the law execution is important, because we can see in the case of Stan News and Apple Daily, the same news appeared in some media, but the news appear in the same media, both the mainstream and the other independent media. That Stan News or Apple Daily News, they will be accused that they tried to publish some seditious publication, but the same news appeared in the mainstream media. So we are talking about how the law execution, and also when we're talking about that what Professor Yang said is the intention to publish. For us, we are journalists. We are just trying to launch or to deliver the information that we can see in the news in the news agency or other media, and we don't have any intention to harm the national security. But but it is not have the same force from the judges or from the authority. So it cannot say that okay you don't need to have too close to worry about this. No, the worries exist every day. Okay, and it depends on which organization you work for. I work for an independent media outlet, so I have to think more about that. Maybe they work for a more mainstream media or government-friendly media. They could have their own thoughts. Okay. If you're asking me the investigative reporting, there's also a worry about it because we will try to grab some information that were maybe not easy to get from the public. So when they work for it, we have to consider what will happen for when we try to make it public, and for the purpose was just for the media purpose, but it will be regarded as a harm to the national security.
Professor Young and then Mrs. Ip, feel free to also add into this. When asking the hypothetical to the both of you, you said that of course, you need to prove that they intend to violate national security by releasing this information. So I think this definition of what exactly national security is very fundamental to what we're talking about. The consultation document notes that many jurisdictions do not seek to define national security, but that this legislation should, quote, be consistent with the laws of our country, i.e. to adopt the same definition in the national security law of the People's Republic of China. Its definition includes, quote, state's political regime, as well as, quote, sustainable economic and social development. So, Professor Young, firstly, how does the breadth of this definition compare to the precedents that are set in case law globally? Mrs. Ip mentioned some of the Five Eyes nations, for example. Mm. How does this definition compare to some of the nations which are mentioned in the document?
Well, in comparison, and as you've mentioned, other countries don't give a definition. So that might well be a worse situation, right? Because you leave it to the courts to, you know, try to figure out what it means, and you really don't have any notion or any idea how it would be defined. And in fact, it's intentionally kept vague and unclear. So here, there is an attempt to at least have an articulation of what national security means. There is a little bit of uncertainty because it does talk about, I think it's the term is the, sort of the basic interests of the state, other basic interests of the state. And so you could add to the definition that you have there. I think it's a useful provision because where other parts of the law make reference to national security, the courts can go back to that definition. And where things are clearly outside the realm of that definition, there will be many things outside the scope of that definition, then you're outside the ordinance. The other important thing I'll say about that definition is the last part of the definition actually talks about sustainability, right? So the notion of sustainable security. So it's not just about, you know, trying to enact those seven prohibitions in Article 23. It's about ensuring that we have a sustained state of security.
The definition, to just go back to it and follow up one final time, includes the state's political regime, i.e. the CCP. Mm-hmm. So would, in my hypothetical situation of this information being released, presumably against the will of the Chinese Communist Party, mm-hmm. could that be a breach of national security as it is defined?
Well, one has to look at the subject matter. It's not so much whether it's against their will or not, right? But it, again, is it a secret? Does it touch upon those seven areas? And if you disclose it, is it likely to endanger national security? You have to go back to the definition. And so if it relates to the political regime, the political party, then it would seem to come within the seven areas. So certainly, when you talk about likely to endanger, it possibly could come within the scope.
It could come within the scope. Mrs. Ip, you wanted to add something?
National security, I'm not aware of any definition in many statutes of many jurisdictions. But you can find the concept of national security in a lot of the consultation documents or strategy papers issued by these countries. You know, UK, for example, well, in my time when I was handling the national security bill of 2002-2003, national security at that time to me only meant protection of China's sovereignty, security, and territorial integrity. You know? But now the concept has moved on. If you look at UK's consultation paper on national security, it is a highly expansive concept, very similar to the holistic concept of national security published by Beijing or US in the National Security Strategy, you know, published a couple of years ago. It embraces not only security, sovereignty, territorial integrity, but also protection of the fundamental political systems, integrity of elections and values and economic security and all that. So in a way, there's a convergence of ideas about what national security should embrace, based on papers published by US National Security Strategy paper, UK's consultation paper on the National Security Act eventually enacted last July, and China's national security papers. And if the court is to interpret it, I think other than looking at the ordinary meaning, it could look into the legislative intent and the pre-enactment background materials.
You mentioned the National Security Act of 2023 passed by the UK Parliament last year. Mm. There was a pretty lengthy consultation period which included the actual language of the bill, the law itself. Will a second consultation period be organized in Hong Kong where the public will have a chance to see the language of the bill and not just a consultation document?
Well, I think when the government publishes the bill, the language, the actual wording will be for everybody to see. And then people could make submissions, could make comments to the government and also to the Legislative Council's Bills Committee.
Mr. Chan.
Yes, I know Regina make it hard, but when you're reading the consultation paper, you can find there are 66 times mentioned in UK national security law and 11 times mentioned about the 2023 national UK security law. But it's very simple question that even a secondary school student could ask. What will happen for a people that he tried to organize a PE election in UK if he wanted to just to win the election for Sunrik's regime? And what will happen if he tried to wear a T-shirt showing that the slogan raising North Ireland or Wales or Scotland independence? Will he be accused or arrested or prosecuted without bail? I'm quite interested why government used so many materials from the UK national security law. And it seems that we can easily to find what's the difference about it.
Let's go to our legal scholar on the panel. So on this secession, clearly different, as Ronson just mentioned, there's political parties, United Kingdom, Sinn Féin, the SNP, this is part of their reason to be. The new First Minister of Northern Ireland has talked about, just in the last couple of weeks, a reunification referendum. Sedition as well is another difference, of course. There's multiple media who advocate for Scottish independence within the law. Sedition and secession are two big differences. What are some of the other differences in terms of the scope of the law and the way it is applied, Professor Young?
Well, yes, as you've mentioned, secession, we've got both different political ideologies, but also a different approach to the law. And also when it comes to sedition, because of course that's been abolished in the UK. But in the past, when we would have seen that there were important differences, but I think given the last 5 years, we see this sort of merging of sort of interests and concerns amongst the Five Eyes. And now we are, in a way, kind of jumping on the bandwagon. And so seeing and acknowledging that there are these other risks, external interference, et cetera, that we're, in a way, almost copying. But I think their experience has been relevant to us. Terrorism, of course, we for many years didn't have very strong anti-terrorism laws, whereas in the UK and other Western countries post September 11th, very, very robust anti-terrorism regimes. So in a way, 2020 national security law, it was a catch-up when we finally had a general terrorism offense. This proposal doesn't deal with terrorism per se. And other areas, of course, insurrection, again, we're seeing a sort of a merger. We're catching up there. In the past, we didn't have a specific offense.
Perhaps we can focus on sedition, as that is a very clear difference, which has also just been raised. So UK abolished sedition, I think, 2009. Yeah. The US does have sedition on the statute books. It also has the First Amendment, however. Hong Kong has existing sedition laws in the statute book, and they've been dusted off in recent years. Yeah. Former Apple Daily publisher Jimmy Lai and your former colleagues, Mr. Chan, Stan News editors Chung Pei Wen and Patrick Lam, are currently facing sedition charges, among several others. So what aspect, Mrs. Ip, of the current sedition law does the government believe is in need of updating?
Mm-hmm. U.S. definitely has the offense of seditious conspiracy. And sedition is not just talking about uttering or publishing stuff critical of the government. Sedition is really about inciting hatred against the fundamental system or the government, incitement towards taking action against the government, And the government, the consultation paper expressly says that this will not erase the protections in Crimes Ordinance Section 9.2 for people to make constructive criticisms or suggestions for improvement. You know. So the sedition offense, from my reading of it, we reactivated it because there have been people inciting people to take action to overthrow government or really to break Hong Kong away from China. So that's why the sedition provisions in Crimes Ordinance have been reactivated in the light of 2019. It's a response to the events of 2019.
Mr. Chan, the proposed law targeting espionage refers to colluding with an external force to publish a statement of fact that is false or misleading to the public, quote unquote. Paul Lam, the Secretary for Justice, tried to assuage the press last week at a press conference you may well have been at personally, saying that the law is targeting intentionally false information, which positions the government somewhat as the arbiter of what is misleading and what indeed is truth. Is this a quasi-fake news law? And to what extent is HAJA concerned about this passage within the consultation document?
Yes, we have a small task force group to read the consultation paper, and some of our members raised this concern to the such the correspondent, they work for the foreign media, which will be subsidized by the government fund. For example, BBC, RFA, that they may be have more concern about such issue, and also I never think about the fake news laws because I think the fake news laws is regulate the local journalists more than the foreigners, but I think it's still very I would say very special that they will try to define our work. It seems the government try to define, regulate our works to see what is fake news, what is wrong information. But sometimes we've got the information from that, and we hope that to clarify from the government side. But they will still publish the news. Maybe they're just saying that we are still waiting for the government comments. But is it kind of the publication fake news? I don't think so. But it still has some dangers that it may be treated as a crime after this the Article 23, the set of laws have been legislated. So I would just say it caused many. How the law and the articles they. It's quite weak, and it is very easy for the journalists to feel dangerous when they in their work, and I think that it may affect the atmosphere for the freedom of press. So that's why we still have a high concern about the legislation.
Professor Young, do you see scope within this proposed ordinance for this passage to be used as a kind of quasi fake news law?
I don't think so. I don't think it was intended to criminalize fake news. When you look at what is being proposed here, there's quite a few elements. And in fact, I think it would be very difficult to prove this offense. Because one of the important elements is you have to prove that the person knew that the statement is false or misleading. Right? So if the person says, well, I believed it to be true, and you raise a reasonable doubt about that, you're not guilty. Right? So it's not going to be easy. And then you also have to prove that the person intended, there's a typo in here, it says engender, it should be endanger, intent to endanger national security or be reckless. Again, coming back to that important safeguard, you have to prove that that person really wanted to endanger national security. Or now recklessness is a lower standard of mens rea, but it's still a subjective standard. We don't have objective standards of recklessness anymore in our law. So you have to prove that the person saw the risk that it's going to endanger national security and still went ahead with it, right? But if they say, well, no, I didn't see that at all because I'm trying to pursue these other legitimate aims or purposes, again, very difficult. And then you have to prove the collusion with external forces, right? And external forces actually defined narrowly as compared to the NSL, Article 29 collusion, because external forces really is about government or an authority of another state or its associated entities or people.
Right. Mr. Chan.
Well, I would like to raise another example. For example, that for the health situation of Lloyd Austin, it disclosed from the U.S. journalists. You can see that the state have recognized this news, but you know that the health of the national leaders in China is another secret also. And you're not easy to get official clarification from the official side. So if we know that this news, should we publish it? Should we launch it? Or if we launch it, that is it kind of that we preach the law for the disclosure of the national secret? But everyone could see this is easily is related to the public interest. But so I may say that. Yes, you can set your consultation, your Article 23 consultation legislation, refer to the set of the foreign laws, but we can easily to find out that the differences and how difficult for the journalists work when after the legislation. I'm just trying to raise the difficulties. I'm not trying to raise any hostile or anything, okay?
Well, there's about 5 questions I could ask based on this issue alone, but I'm conscious of time and I want to give chance for the audience to ask questions. I'm going to ask a final question to Mrs. Ip and then open things up to the floor. Mrs. Ip, in 2003, a reported 500,000 people took to the streets in protest the last time the government attempted to enact domestic national security legislation. The 3-month consultation period, as it was at the time, drew over 90,000 submissions, according to government data. From the government's point of view, the response this time has been positive at best and muted at worst. Mm. What's changed?
They have learned the lessons from my fiasco. You know, you see, the first about the numbers who took to the street, they were not just protesting the national security bill. There was also a lot of anger about the SARS casualties, almost 300 dead. People thought government mishandled SARS, and also a lot of anger about negative home values. So it's not just Article 23, to be fair. And secondly, since then, a lot of the issues, including what Watson raised, if reporters reporting on pandemic data in the mainland, would they fall foul of theft of state secrets or espionage offense? You know, these issues have been discussed many times in the past 20 years. You know, so the government doesn't need to spend as much time as I did 20 years ago to go over the details. But my answer to Ronson will be, if you are publishing something already in the public arena, it's not a secret. And it's not something you obtained access by unauthorized means. And if you don't have the intention to endanger national security, I don't see how a prosecution against you could be successful.
Let's open questions up to the floor. I'll ask people to keep their questions brief. I'll ask people to keep their questions to one each, and I'll ask people to keep their questions to questions rather than statements, please. We will cut you off. I think the first hand was just over there. Ms. Lau.
Thank you very much, Lee. Being a former HKJA chair, I, of course, share many of Ronson's concerns, and I hope Regina and her colleagues will take them into account. In 2003, one of the biggest worry of the people who marched and who didn't march was the possibility of criminalizing free speech. Now, in the consultation document, paragraph 2.6, it referred to forces trying to promote messages endangering national security by making use of so-called artistic creations released through media like publication, music, film, arts, and culture. And then in paragraph 2.2, refers to curbing the noxious phenomenon of inciting hatred and contempt against the state and the SAR authorities. I think the panel knows that in the last few weeks, a number of drama performances in high school and in the Academy for Performing Arts were banned, were axed, stirring up people's concern whether they are going to breach this law. So, I mean, I want the panel to tell us, and also the paragraph refer to soft resistance, mm-hmm. as you refer to Lee. And last year when we had the panel discussion on the NSL, there was a lot of discussion about soft resistance, and the term came up again in this consultation document. So, should people in this room, journalists or non-journalists, be worried about criminalizing free speech? I hope Ronson and his colleagues will not be arrested, whether it's before the enactment of the law or after, because there are so many red lines and grey areas that people are not sure about. Thank you.
Mrs. Yip.
No such thing as absolute freedom of speech. In Article 19 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, it already says the freedom of expression carries special duties and responsibilities and can be circumscribed in accordance with the law to protect national security, order, public safety, public morals. So there's no absolute freedom of speech. That's why many countries have enacted laws to proscribe seditious conspiracy. And the offense of sedition is a very old offense, both a common law offense and a statutory offense. As for the instances, the examples you mentioned, the drama performances, I think what people were wondering was why were the performances not allowed to go ahead, rather than whether they were foul of national security offenses.
Didn't they not?
That's my reading.
Professor Young?
I'll simply say, Mrs. Yip has referred to this U.S. offense of seditious conspiracy. And I think what happened in January 2021 in the storming of the Capitol building in Washington, 2,000 people apparently were there, and hundreds have been prosecuted with seditious conspiracy and convicted. So that, you know, in place U.S., where First Amendment freedom of speech, you know, you can still see there are limits to that kind of expression. And I think sedition, you know, it's almost by definition is a speech crime. But the question is, it's not, you know, whether that in itself is acceptable or not, but it's sort of, you have to look at the rationale and of course also the need for that offense.
Mr. Chan, the question addressed the panel. Anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think that the red line is floating and moving. I remember in 2003, in the last edition, that the government accepted that the speech may be accused or prosecuted if it caused instant violence. But I think that it's quite different from now today, our understanding. Yes, Regina said it's yes. There is no such absolute freedom of speech, but I think we are easily to explain this, to distinguish how the difference from Hong Kong and the outside world.
Thank you. Take another question. Over there. Please do identify yourself and your affiliation.
Yes, thank you. Tom Gnocchi from the EU office. Thank you for this panel. On our side, there's significant concern about this upcoming piece of legislation. We understand that this is a constitutional obligation. We also don't understand that there's no questioning that Hong Kong needs national security legislation. That's not the issue. We're looking at the track record now coming up to 4 years of NSL that raises some concerns in relation to what is being proposed. I'll get to my question. So there are significant concerns which we've conveyed to the government. A lot was discussed on state secrets and the wide definitions there. Not so much there was a reference to the other another part of the consultation document relating to external interference. This is another area which concerns us, and in particular in relation to the. I don't have the text with me, but I think it refers to external interference in relation to formulation and implementation of policy, if I remember the wording correctly. So I'd be interested in views on that particular aspects and also on certain broad definitions in the area of external interference as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Mrs. Yip?
Yeah, this is a new offense added by several countries in recent years. Australia, you know, in 2018, Singapore, and also it's newly included in the UK's National Security Act. UK has talks about foreign interference and also foreign influence. They actually has a foreign influence registration scheme, you know, failure to do which could attract a penalty of 5 years imprisonment. Now, what we have is only prohibition of certain improper conduct if it is in collusion with external forces. Now, UK used the term foreign power condition. So again, there are several elements. The conduct has to be improper. UK calls it prohibited conduct. We call it improper conduct, you know, like spreading fake news, you know, influencing government policies, interfering with elections, influencing the electrical and discharging its duties, interfering with the function of the judiciary. Another very important precondition is collusion with an external force. Now, external force is not defined yet in this document, but you will be working with an external force if you are acting as a principal of an external force or under direction of an external force, which could be a government of a country or the government of, say, Taiwan, you know, and accepting financial subsidies, assistance to do certain improper acts. So this offence is actually in line with what Australia, UK, Singapore has enacted. But we are not introducing, government is not introducing a registration scheme, just keeping it to interference as improper conduct, which will be defined in the law, and not broadening it to cover influence. Yeah.
Professor Young, we're talking legal definitions. Would you care to weigh in?
Yeah, I think EUFs probably will be counted as an external force, and hence, I think you have to. I appreciate your concerns, but when coming to this particular offense, external interference, again, there are many elements, and I think the critical element is the improper means, because if you look at the list of improper means, most of them are bad things that you wouldn't normally do. Right, unless you're committing a crime. So, however, there are a few things in there that might be a bit broad, like causing someone financial loss. I can think of maybe one or two examples where you probably wouldn't want to call it a crime of external interference. And I was just playing with some ideas, like maybe, you know, as a lawyer, you're representing a foreign government, suing a party, you're going to cause them financial loss. That's not improper, right? But technically, you might come within that offense. So you might can think of problems, possibly some possible examples. But because of when you're assisting a foreign government, you're in a way collaborating with them under the definition of collaboration. Right. So you know we are borrowing from the UK a law that's untested, very new. We're trying to, you know, when you look at the language, it's not an entire cut and paste. But I think the basic ideas are there, and I think maybe there's still some room to discuss, you know, its parameters.
We have time for one more question, expedient. Sorry, Mr. Chen.
I think it's not difficult for us to illustrate how, which you know, mentioned example as Australia and Singapore, their fear for external interference, that is, some power to try to affect the election. But we can see is we, for the past experience, is any interference for the election for Hong Kong will interfere by the external power? We have seen no. So, but anyway, if you, it is a protective action, I have no comment about it. But I would say this kind of the articles related to the external interference that will make it change not I don't think it will cause a massive arrest in Hong Kong that people may regard to push this law. But I think it changed the atmosphere. The atmosphere is that the less and less journalists, less and less Hong Kong general people or citizens, they were willing to communicate and talk with the foreign journalists, foreign correspondents. So this changed the atmosphere, not many people may be arrested, not this, but it will change the atmosphere that people may more fear about to communicate with the foreign authority, especially that I mentioned that some media organization, they were funded by the government, subsidized, and it still have chance that they may be have such accusation with them.
Thank you, Martin. Any further questions? Okay, I see one back there, stood up. I think that's probably the last question we have time for.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, will the media be in breach under Article 23 if they publish any information, leaks, details about the budget before February 28th? And that's for Ms. Ip.
Well, I think it comes back to the condition, whether leaking, you know, the certain facts, certain aspects of the budget, say the size of the deficit, would endanger national security before 28 February. I think it would be rather far-fetched to suggest that disclosing, you know, the size of the budget deficit or whether the government will remove the stamp duties on property will endanger national security. So my own answer is unlikely.
Mrs. Ip, I'm going to ask a final question. Yes. It pertains to a point that Mr. Chan raised about trust, about the atmosphere in Hong Kong, particularly with regards to foreign collaboration and so on. How will the government work to reassure and assuage the international business community, diplomatic community, that the principle of one country, two systems, the bedrock of Hong Kong status as an international center for commerce and investment, remains steadfast once this law is enacted?
First of all, I think the government needs to double down on explaining the nature of the offense of external interference. You know, what sort of interference they're talking about is examples are given in the consultation paper. And what sort of conduct constitutes improper conduct is actually, as Professor Young said, things that you shouldn't do, deception, coercion, say online bullying, spreading fake information, that sort of thing. If a journalist talk to a foreign government or a foreign political party about things happening in Hong Kong, not spreading fake news or using deceptive means, I don't think you can fall foul of that offense. So I think the government needs to double down on explaining the nature of these offenses. You know.
There's been so much ground that we could have covered that weren't able to get into, foreign interference being one of them, the faith of the international business community being another. I hope this won't be the last event we have at the FCC on Article 23, and we'll be able to get into those topics as well. But for now, this has been an interesting conversation, entered in good faith by our three panelists. So I'd like to thank you all for joining us, and I'd like to thank our three panelists for entering this conversation in good faith and for sharing their thoughts as well. Please join me in giving a round of applause to them. Thank you.
Thanks for listening in to this special edition of The Correspondent. Don't forget, you can find the Foreign Correspondents Club of Hong Kong on all your usual social platforms like Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Just search for FCCHK, you'll find us. And don't forget, you can access our entire video archive of lunchtime panels and special guests. Everything from discussions about the missing Malaysia Airlines flight, to Michael Palin talking Monty Python, to Chris Patton, and Nobel Prize winning journalist Maria Ressa. Just search for FCC Hong Kong on YouTube. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.